I am so thankful for the music. Thank you. Well-chosen songs. I'm thankful for the prayers I've heard this morning, speaking to where we're at today. And I'm thankful because I know good and well, I may not need this. Turn to Daniel while I'm yakking, if you will, please. You start in the middle and then turn east, and you'll find it. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Pastor Dan has been speaking to the issues that are confronting us. And so he has also prepared the way for where we're at this morning. I better warn you now, if you have a pot roast in the oven timed for when you normally get home, better pick up something on your way, because it might be a little overdone. I am going to speak a bit long this morning. If you feel the need to sleep, there's no impediments. I was opening a women's retreat up in our church in Tok, Alaska one time, and I was greeting the ladies, and of course this was a camp out retreat. These were all bush gals, came from different villages and towns to our little community for this retreat yearly. And my brain was not engaged. Okay, that's my defense. And I said, you're welcome to, throw your sleeping bags down wherever you like. You're welcome to sleep on the pews. And I looked down at how narrow they were, and without thinking, I said, if you think you'll fit. A year later, I got up to address that same women's retreat. Before I got a word out of my mouth, somebody said, watch it. That was the last time I ever addressed the women's retreat. So, I would like to bring you a message today that's based on three things that happened a few years back. By a few, I mean about 2,625 years back, give or take a few months. We're looking at Daniel chapter 1, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to spotlight briefly three incidents in Daniel, and you'll see them as we go along. But to set the stage, the kingdom of Judah has been judged by God and condemned to spend 70 years in captivity in Babylon. How many of you have read the Old Testament? Okay. How many of you have not read the Old Testament? Be brave. Be honest. Okay. How many of you have read Daniel? Okay. Good, 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 good. I'm glad most of you will know where we're at. In any event, the kingdom of Judah, the people of Judah, were now living in captivity in Babylon under what we would have to call a hostile government. Say what? Yes. Well, that's exactly where I'm going. It was a government with different moral values. It served other gods, and it was not always tolerant of those who they deemed to be in their way. It doesn't take a whole lot of effort, does it, for us to link Babylon to America today? And we don't know for sure what God has in his mind, but I am so grateful somebody mentioned it this morning. We know that God is sovereign over the affairs of men. Not a subatomic particle in any atom in all of creation moves without the will of God. So he is in control. Boy. Sorry, just the COVID acts up once in a while. Don't mind me.
Watch it.
Yeah, watch it. There are only two people in here prepared, but good. With that as our first assurance, not my cough and the COVID, but the fact that God is sovereign, let me tell you what we truly have that we can be thankful for, even under a hostile government. And I will let you know that this sermon is dated. I actually prepared this sermon just before Thanksgiving, and the things I'm mentioning now are so far back in our past because things are going so fast. But I'm sure they're still very much with us, but some of my quotes are a little bit back then. We are living under a government with entirely different morals than we have. Oh, bless you, my son. That was a Protestant blessing. Thank you. excuse me, boy. I got it. We'll get this together. In fact, I would say that roughly half of America holds to different values than we have, considering, you know, how you want to count the population. And in fact, most of the unbelieving world is accepting those same values. There we go. There's an unsanctified spot to put it. Three things to be thankful for this morning. Let's be thankful, first of all, that we have a clean and a holy moral code to live by, one that is entirely different from the world's. Do I hear an amen on that one? Yeah. Let's start this by exploring Daniel's diet, or explore this by starting Daniel's diet. How shall we? I'm in chapter 1 of Daniel. I'm going to read verses 8 on down through 16 and then sum up from there. Excuse me. Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were taken captive to Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar, and they were put into the kingdom. They were prepared to be of service in the kingdom, and the Lord had, or I should say the Lord, their names were changed to Belteshazzar, Hananiah, Shadrach, and Meshach, and Abednego. I'm going to get all this out one way or another. And they were brought food for them to eat. And picking up in verse 8, but Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. And so he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now, God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your face looking more haggard than the youths, haggard than the youths who are your own age? And then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence, and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. I'm on a vegetable diet, as you can see. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink, and kept giving them vegetables. And then we would just go on down from there and see that they were found to be very worthy in the kingdom. Eating meat is not condemned. Let me make that clear at the outset here. But the offered food was almost certainly unclean according to the standards set in Jewish law. Almost certainly the animals butchered for meat would not have been bled out. And the Jews were forbidden to eat food that, you know, meat that contained the blood. Very possibly they would have been meat that was sacrificed to pagan gods, and that would definitely defile them spiritually. And so rather than defile themselves with food that would have been repulsive to them, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel instead requested and received food that they could eat in all good conscience. And God honored that decision. It was the right thing to do. And that was the food diet of four godly men. Now let's consider the world, the current world's moral diet. it's okay for us to go from one to the other because both have to do with living a lifestyle that is free from contamination, whether it's contamination by unclean food or unclean morals. To my mind, and I'll explain my order of priorities here in a moment, the most important first moral issue, let me say this again, I think the most important moral issue at this point in history is the sanctity of life. Nancy Pelosi was asked a few months back, huh?
That's a really hard word to come out with sometimes.
I have several names that are hard to come up with. Was asked a few months ago about something she was doing, and she famously said, it's all about the children. And this is the woman who wholeheartedly promotes Planned Parenthood and believes that it is a woman's fundamental right to murder her children, even up past the point of birth. There's something very dark and sick and twisted about this woman's thinking and about her heart and the people who stand with her. Now, I say that's first on the list of moral issues that are wrong. The second major item on this list of the world's moral diet is sexual immorality and perversion. 4 years ago, when Obama was replaced, somebody made the comment that Kennedy put a man on the moon. Obama put a man in the women's bathroom. Yeah, what a contrast. Now, third grade children are being taught that they can be any gender they want to be. They don't even know what gender is. And they have something like 26 combinations to choose from. Third grade children. If that doesn't... That to my mind, that is child sexual abuse, to offer a child the right to something they don't even know about like that. Why do I say that these are the two, I'm going to say these are the two major sins against that mankind can commit. And why do I say that? If you consider the universe that we live in, there are galaxies billions of light years away. This world that we live in is crawling with life, just amazing. The splendor of God is displayed in the heavens, is displayed on earth, but the pinnacle of God's creation is us. Created alone, even the angels cannot say, created in the image of God. Don't mess with the image of God. Killing the children is an abomination in the eyes of God. Killing any innocent life and messing with the norms for sexuality that God has put in place, that is an abomination in the sight of God. These two are the sins that you see all through the Bible. Sexual perversion and murder over and over. Those make God very angry. Now, I'll go on from those because there is a third and last item on the world's moral diet that I want to add here, and that is irresponsibility. It's not quite up there maybe with the others, but our hostile government is promoting social justice policies that actually encourage responsibility. And let's just take first, I'm not even going to go into racial irresponsibility or this or that, but let's think financial irresponsibility. Why should I take responsibility for my actions and my bills? They're not my fault, I'm a victim. The college just charged too much for me to get a degree in gender studies. I demand government help. It's my right. Right? No, it's not, is it? And by catering, forgive me for sarcasm, somebody told me once that sarcasm is not a fruit of the Spirit. But then I looked and I saw that both Jesus and Paul used sarcasm. So, yep. By catering to these poor, abused people, the government is actually discouraging those who work for a living and striving to make their lives meaningful. They're discouraging them. After all, why should I work if the government is going to give my money to others? Where do I go to sign up? And I'll tell you truthfully, with the aid package that is being talked about right now for those who are on unemployment, and I agree for those who are on unemployment, but it's going to make it more productive for them to stay on unemployment than to go back to work. Back in my hippie days, B.C., before Christ, I found myself in the position where I came off the Alaska pipeline, and when it was done, found myself unemployed, living high on the hog. I finally took a job for almost a whole day and figured out I was making more on unemployment, so I quit. Thank God I changed. So that's kind of the world we're in. And, of course, with the outbreaks of violence around our nation, many in our government want to stop supporting police and take away guns from legal owners, non-criminals. Now, I don't know if the figures were accurate or not because I didn't write them down, but a post on Facebook, oh, don't you just love how Facebook is always so truthful? Yes. never mind. But I did like this one. It was a few months back, and it read something like this. Legal gun owners in America own 300 million guns and something like 5 trillion rounds of ammunition. If we were the problem, you'd know it. Yeah, that one stuck with me. If we were the problem, hey, this would be a big time. Now, I apologize for opening the septic tank this morning, but this is something of a summary of the moral diet or moral code of our current world, and it includes our government that we have here. Let's thank God that as Christians, we have a clean and holy moral code to live by. God tells us, you shall be holy for I am holy. And this is a both command and a responsibility and a privilege. I love being holy. It doesn't mean I always like trying to be holy. Don't get the two confused, because I still am fighting that sin nature. But I love knowing that I can walk in holiness with the Lord. It is so pleasing. I've been on the other side. It's filthy. I prefer to live in holiness. It was during a time of the persecution in the early church that Peter wrote in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lust, which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation." And I can see that in one of two ways. Either they're going to glorify God because they looked at us, saw Christ, and came to Christ, or on trembling, bowed knees, they're going to glorify God by admitting that we were the holy ones and they were not. Now, one way or the other there. Those whose lives are contaminated and defiled are watching us. They are observing how we live. And we have the godly resources, we have the responsibility to show them a lifestyle that is holy and clean, altogether different from theirs. This is what Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were doing. They were saying, we will not live according to your standards there. We have different standards. As Paul exhorted the Romans in his letter to them in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, "Therefore I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, submit your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect." And of course, we all know that the problem with living sacrifices is they always keep trying to crawl off the altar, but that's where we should be, up there where we are a sacrifice to God. So since we have a clean and holy moral code to live by, let's continue to live lives of cleanliness and holiness. Daniel and his three companions lived as God directed, and God honored them for it. He will honor us as well, even if our hostile government doesn't. So now, the second thing, and the roast is slowly saying, when are they coming home? Okay. Second thing we must be thankful for is that we know the one true God. Amen. I just, you blessed the socks off me, so to speak. Just exalting God this morning. Thank you. Yeah, that resonated. It really did. Our next story is in chapter 3 of Daniel. So you don't have to go very far. And I'm going to talk about leading up to the fiery furnace. But I'm not going to talk about the fiery furnace. That's really not the part of the story I want to bring out. But what led up to it and the decision that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego made. And I'm going to read a fairly lengthy passage, chapter 3. I'm going to skim a fairly lengthy passage, and I may even paraphrase it in some parts. How's that? Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 60 cubits, and he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all those government guys to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And then all of those government guys, that's a good way to put it, were assembled there at the image, and they stood before it. And then the herald, I'm in verse 4 now, the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nation, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. Therefore, at that time when all of the peoples heard the sound of all the noisy instruments, they all fell down and worshiped the golden instrument, that golden instrument image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And for that reason, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. And they responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, 'O king, live forever. You yourself, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of all these noisy instruments is to fall down,'" forgive my jumping over those, "'is to fall down and worship the golden image, but whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. Now, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you,'" laying it on thick here, "'they do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up.' And then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they were brought before the king. And Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, 'Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you were ready at the sound of all of these instruments, I want you to fall down and worship. If you will not, you will be cast into that blazing fire. And what God is there, here's the challenge, who can deliver you out of my hands?'" Verse 16, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not," there's the recognition of the sovereignty of God, "even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." The summary, Nebuchadnezzar got quite angry. And for all the little bits I've been saying about the noisy instruments and whatnot, this really happened. We're not talking fables here. This is a historical event. And imagine being back there. He had them thrown into the furnace. It was heated 7 times hotter than usual. In fact, it killed the guys who threw them in there. It was so hot. They were not touched by the fire. Nebuchadnezzar looked into the fire, saw 4 individuals, one of them like the Son of God, walking around. He finally had them brought out of the fire and saw that they had not even been singed. Not their clothing, not anything. There wasn't even a smell of smoke upon them. And then he said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." And I'll leave it right there. These 3 saints actually had positions of authority in Nebuchadnezzar's hostile government. And yet they boldly refused to bow down before the pagan gods of Babylon, knowing they would be thrown into the fire. And why? Because they trusted the one true God, the same God that you and I know. Like Babylon and every other pagan empire in those days, our world has lots of gods. In fact, India actually boasts of having some 30 million gods. 30 million gods. I asked my class one day, how did they get so many gods? And they said, well, they procreate. And I said, didn't anybody ever teach the Hindu gods about birth control? They've really gotten out of hand over there. But thankfully, America isn't trying to compete. But our country has given in to too many false gods recently. Our government demands that we bow down to them. I'm going to say, and this is just my own opinion, evolution is arguably the biggest god in America today and in most of the Western world, and it's being taught in schools in India as well. It is taught in our schools as proven fact that there is no creator, that everything came from nothing with no outside help and mindlessly progressed into billions of incredibly complex and irreversible, that's not the word I wanted, irreducible complexities. In other words, how can an eye evolve with all the parts that had to be part of it when all of those are needed in order to see? There is no intelligence in evolution to say, okay, we need these cones, we need this cornea, we need the retina, we need all of this to put it together. There just is not. And, you know, all of the planets, all of the life that you see on Earth, everything, if you believe that this was all intelligently designed, you are called a fool. If you are in academia and try to teach against evolution, you are no longer in academia. You are blacklisted. You do not have tenure. You don't have a job, period. Growing up, I cut my eye teeth on science fiction. Isaac Asimov was one of my favorite authors. We're of that age. He did make the comment one time. He said, what Christians believe is incredibly stupid. I think he has his theology all straightened out now.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm afraid so. He's been dead for quite a while. The second God of America, one worshipped by our incoming government officials, is humanism. Now, I asked my smartphone to define humanism. Okay, electronic device, tell me about being a person. something odd about that, I know. But I like the definition. It says, humanism is an outlook or system of thought attaching prime importance to human rather than divine or supernatural matters. Humanist beliefs stress the potential value and goodness of human beings, emphasize common human needs, and seek solely rational ways of solving human problems. And I'll speak to that just momentarily. Greed is the third god I want to mention. Greed's brothers are coveting and materialism. And you often see them together pushing overloaded carts at Stuff Mart. This is the public view. This is what we see. Behind the scenes, money is a major driving factor in our world, and a, if you will, a major hidden god that's moving things forward. And that brings me, though, to the major god that our new government bows down to more than any other, and that is the god called power. The god of total control over the lives of others. We have rights that are supposedly protected by constitutional amendments, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, the freedom of peaceful assembly, the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, and the right to bear arms, among others that are out there. The God of power hates those freedoms because it wants to control and take away all of them so that they can have that absolute control. These are some of the gods that our world and our new government worship. The one God they do not really want to worship is Jesus Christ. Anything can be sacred except Christianity in any conservative form. They're okay with, and I really shouldn't mention names, but I will, they are okay with our current president being shown kneeling in prayer in a Catholic church and at the same time restarting the Mexico City agreement to pay for abortions around the world. God says even the prayers of the wicked are an abomination before him. That's a facade of religiosity that has... I can't even finish that up. Only God knows if there are fiery furnaces in our future for standing up against these gods. And of course, lest we forget the rights of the LGBTQWXYZ crowd are going to push aside the rights of anything or anyone that gets in the way of their march to even greater power. And that's all I'm going to say about that damnable movement. Excuse me for using the word, but we truly need to be thankful that we know the only true God of all creation. We know who is in control, and that is an absolute. And let's remind ourselves then of where he stands amidst these false gods. To keep things in perspective, looking back at what I've just talked about these gods, let's remind ourselves, first of all, that evolutionary theory is nonsense. Nothing simply cannot come. Anything cannot come from nothing. How do I want to say that? If I can recreate the Big Bang, I don't know if that's current theory or not, but I believe it went something like this. Before the beginning, when there was nothing, period, a non-existent force exerted non-existent pressure on nothing so that nothing finally couldn't stand the non-existent force any longer and exploded into everything. There is a God who has, yes.
I've read in multiple places, so it must absolutely be true in the scientific journals, that the matter that all the universe came from was actually the size of the period at the end of the sentence. And I've read that in some serious things.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously, I don't know where the dot came from, but just to back up what you're saying.
So the question is, who first dotted the page?
Who said there's a period?
Yeah, who says there's a period? You know, the incredibly complex designs at every level of creation could not exist without a designer. DNA, the coding, could not exist without a code writer. The designer of all things large and small can only be a God, a true God, the one true God, period. Yeah, and he did not start with a dot.
You could say he started with a Big Bang.
Huh?
In creation?
Yep. Boom.
Sunday bang or whatever.
Yes. There. He is theologically termed the uncaused cause, which you have to have for there to be something. There has to be something that was eternally uncaused in order to create material like that. Second, looking at the God of humanism and self, mankind does have value because God gave us value. He created us in his image, but man disobeyed, man fell into sin, man fell into rebellion, and man is utterly incapable of doing anything right apart from the grace of God. Man's governments, no matter how well conceived, will always ultimately fail because man is a sinner and he will inevitably take advantage of them. God is the Lord, not man. The three bloated gods of greed, coveting, and materialism have a simple motto, me, me, me. I'm reminded of a cartoon years ago. I think it was Nemo, Finding Nemo or something. And all the seagulls. The only scene I remember in the whole movie was all these seagulls saying, "Mine, mine, mine, mine." They all all after something. And I thought, yeah, I know seagulls. So that's all I remember from the movie. Anyway, where was I? Okay. The one true God. I'm sorry, I'm making it longer and longer, and your roast is now crispy crittered. The one true God whom we follow has given us so much to enjoy in this life, especially here in America. I sometimes look around at our material possessions and feel ashamed because I think of my family down in Tamil Nadu in South India who do not have these things, live very, very primitively. It almost breaks my heart to see, you know, my daughter adopted out there scrubbing a bar of soap on the rocks, literally, to wash the clothes every day. You know, it is, we are, the poorest of us in this room is wealthy in comparison to a large part of the world's population. But the one true God's material blessings on us are meant to be used gratefully, responsibly, and unselfishly. It is not a sin to be wealthy. It's a sin to say, mine, 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 all mine. So it truly is better to give than receive. And then there is the great God power. In Matthew chapter 20, verses 20 to 28, the dear mother of James and John just asked Jesus to let her son sit in the places of power and authority, his right and left hand, when he came into his kingdom. She just wanted the best for her kids. You know, any mother would do that, right? So I won't ask that. And Jesus replied to her and to the 12, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." We are called to honor and serve the living God by serving others, and he set the example for us. So since we do have the joy of knowing the one true God, let us be careful to follow him and not the false gods of this world. Let's not give in to the gods of well, everything. I'll just say that. Even if being true to our God could lead to a fiery furnace someday. Now, the third thing that we really need to be thankful for, really, 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 is that we have the almost indescribable honor of having a personal relationship with the one true God. That, to use old phraseology, boggles my mind. It isn't really a lack of belief in God that bothers me. It's what troubles me the most is it almost seems too good to be true that we have an eternal relationship with God, and someday this world is not even going to be an afterthought. It will be so far removed. I want to treat this story just simply and briefly. Daniel chapter 6. Look at our last story. And I do want to read verses 1 through 11 in their entirety. And it seemed good, to Darius, depending on how you pronounce it, to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of which Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. I might add that he possessed an extraordinary spirit because he was faithful to God, and God was blessing him. Then in verse 4, the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs, but they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows, "King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the prefects and the satraps and the high officials and the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked." And therefore, seemingly without asking any questions about it, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. And then verse 10. "Now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. And then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God." And they disclosed this to the king. The king, grieving, had no choice. He was law-abiding. He had them thrown into, had Daniel thrown into the lion's den. The lions did not touch them. An angel shut their mouths. And the morning the king came out just grieving, said, "Daniel, did your Lord preserve you?" And he said, "Yes, I'm unharmed." He was brought out of there. And I can't imagine the stupidity of these three people thinking that by destroying the king's favorite, they were actually going to get his job. Anyway, they did get his job. They wound up feeding the lions. And end of the story. And Daniel was exalted. And that's enough for the moment. Here we see the disciples, of the god coveting, who also goes by the name envy, very hard at work, trying to satisfy their greed and their hatred. But look at Daniel. He held a high position in Darius' government. He had been informed by his loyal servants, no doubt, about what was going on. He would have had servants out there watching everything. He knew what his enemies had done against him, and he knew why. And yet Daniel had a genuine personal relationship with the one true God. His godly character was evident to everyone who watched him and knew him. And in spite of knowing that it would lead to his death, he still kept up his habit of prayer on his knees before an open window three times a day. Knowing death was watching at his window, Daniel simply kept on worshiping God as before. His personal relationship with God was the most important thing in his life, even important to the point that he was willing to die for it. Now let me add a little something in here. It is not wrong when you're being pursued by those who hate you to get out of town. The Apostle Paul did that. It is not wrong to go into hiding to escape persecution. But when you're in a position and you can't do those things, that's when we need to stand fast, isn't it? And I would hope that each of us here this morning has that personal relationship with the Lord Jesus Christ, with the one true living God. And I would hope and pray that it is the most important thing in our lives as well, even if we find the need to die for it someday, if it ever should come to that. Being rock solid in our faith is of the utmost importance. And it means, simply put, we must be faithful, even knowing that an increasingly hostile government may be watching at our windows. We must be faithful individually, in praying regularly, in worshiping regularly, in living as believers should live according to that holy moral code that we have. We must also be faithful corporately. We need each other. We need to be coming together in fellowship and worship. We were designed by God to need one another and help one another. We need that strength and encouragement that comes with numbers. We need to be regularly in the Word of God. Without it, we will surely starve, and we shall surely stumble if we're not in it. And so, because we do have an almost indescribable honor of a personal relationship with God, it makes it all that more important that we are diligent in keeping our faith and worship alive, both personally and as a church. And I realize, I've come to the end, few more words. I realize I have not dealt with anything but generalities this morning. You know, we have things the Apostle Paul did not have, that Daniel did not have. We can vote. We have rights enshrined in our Bill of Rights and whatnot. Paul didn't conceive of those things. But he did say, obey your government. And that was during the time of Nero. And then Peter said, when they had been caught out preaching the gospel again, out in the marketplace, we must obey God rather than men. How do we balance that? Where the government asks us to do lawful, moral things, we abide by them. Okay? We may not like it, but we have a commitment to our integrity before God. When they stray and they say, okay, we want you to stop doing those things, we demand that you stop doing those things that are good and Christian. No. We must obey God rather than man. And I will say this, it may generate some controversy. I'm a gun owner, have been all my life. I'm from Alaska. I grew up with a gun in my hands. I still have guns. Okay. I have 3,000 rounds of 22 ammo. Did I get that because I think I'm going to have to defend my home? No, I just made sure I had enough plinking ammo for the rest of my life in case they do away with it. And I enjoy my rights of free speech. I enjoy the freedom that I have here that I don't have in India to go and share my faith and such like that. But when push comes to shove, I am more concerned about my responsibilities than I am about my rights. Yeah. And you can draw the...
More concerned about responsibilities than...
Rights. Yeah. And you can draw the lines however you will. I'm not your conscience here or your guide on that. But I will always weigh, how do I appear before men? Now, I will throw one other thing in here. I was talking about... I was in India. I was sharing with my students there in Dehradun, and we got on the subject of persecution, and we brought up the story of Corrie Ten Boom. Has anybody here not heard of Corrie Ten Boom? Okay. You need to find out about Corrie Ten Boom. Jewish family during the war were, I'm sorry, Christian family during the war were harboring Jews, keeping them safe and getting them smuggled out of Holland to safety. Eventually, they were caught. The Jews that they had in safety at that time actually were not caught, and they were spirited out by the Gestapo, so they saved their lives. But everybody except for Corrie Ten Boom, all her family died in the concentration camps, and she went on to just be an incredible spokesman for the Lord after that. And the question was put, if I were in such a position and lives were at stake, would I lie? And I said, in a heartbeat, I would lie to save someone's life. Yes. Mm-hmm. And that's what she essentially was doing.
Would you lie to save your own life?
That's a good question. That one would give me pause enough. I am afraid, really. I have a concealed license. I carry at camp because we need security there. We had to come up with a policy, and that would be carriers. I am afraid of carrying a gun in some place for protection, because if something were to happen, I would hesitate too long before I shot somebody. Yeah.
Gary, I have a friend who I regard as a very, very good Bible teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And he does draw that line that when it comes to a personal affront, personal persecution, a threat, I have no choice. I take it. Mm-hmm. When it comes to a threat to my wife, it's different. I'm now taking steps to protect another person.
Yep.
And that's different than protecting myself with falsehood.
Yeah, myself is not important. Yeah, myself is important in serving Christ. And that's why we need to consider, okay, what am I have, how, let me start over. In situations of difficulty, am I being the representative of the Christ who went to the cross without complaint for me? Yeah, there's our line. Just to wrap this up, 2020 was kind of like being smacked in the face with a wet salmon and a smelly one at that. And without expecting it, it came from behind. Okay. Yeah. And I don't really prophesy that 2021 is going to be any better. In fact, I stayed up late on New Year's Eve to make sure that 2020 left, and then I locked all the doors and windows afterwards to keep it gone. But somehow 2021 sort of snuck in. But like a clean, deep breath of winter air, look at the three things that I've laid out before you this morning, the three wonderful things that we have to be thankful for. That as Christians, we have a clean, a holy, and a satisfying moral code to live by. Two, that we know the one true God. He is not some made-up little one of 30 million out there. And we have an incredible personal relationship with God, a relationship that will last for all eternity. Think about that. For these things and much, much more, we can truly be thankful. And in a world that is growing ever, ever darker, these are the three things that we need to sustain light and life in us. Amen. Let's pray.